fields of bodies burning as the war machine keeps turning. Death and hatred to mankind, poisoning their brainwashed minds. Oh, Lord, yeah.
Hi, this is Bob Petrakis bringing you the other side of the news.
And I'm Dan Dugan, the other guy on the other side. WGRN, the Green Renaissance.
Hello, this is Bob Petrakis. You're listening to the other side of the news. And I'm here today with Pastor Sally Padgett, a native of Columbus, Ohio, who did her undergraduate work at North Carolina State University, where she received a degree in communications and public relations. And after graduating from North Carolina State, she stayed in Raleigh, North Carolina, where she met her husband, Michael, worked in electronic sales and has two children. After the birth of her children, she moved back to Columbus, where her husband took a job at Cardinal Health. Sally started seminary in 2000, going part-time to learn more about her faith, never dreaming she would become a pastor. And I suspect never dreaming she'd be involved in so many controversies. Going part-time to learn about her faith. Again, she became a pastor. And after completing an 18-month-long internship at First English Lutheran Church over in our neighborhood where our studio is on the side, she fell in love with urban ministry. Okay, she likes it a bit difficult. Yeah. Main Street over there, it's on the uprise. She completed her seminary work and graduated from Trinity Lutheran Seminary, also on the east side, near the campus, Capital University. After being ordained in 2013, she went back to First English, served as an associate pastor. Between her time as an associate pastor and coming on as the lead pastor at First English, Sally was trained in church redevelopment. She'll have to explain the meaning of that. Her new focus was to enliven the First English, but not in a Pentecostal way. So new and creative ways, not involving speaking in tongues. Sally has served as the lead pastor of First English since 2016. Throughout her time as pastor, Sally has led dozens of groups and churches through training in Bridges Out of Poverty. Sounds like a very interesting program. And in being a sanctuary church. Welcome to the other side of the news. Sounds like you're making a lot of news on the alternative and other side. So welcome
to
the show.
We try. Thank you.
So how do you become a sanctuary church?
Actually, for our church, it was kind of a simple path. Some churches, you know, it takes a while to decide. We, on a Wednesday afternoon, I was on a conference call with other pastors. They were talking about the need for a sanctuary church. They had just been at a Faith and Public Life meeting that morning. They were looking for a sanctuary church. And I said, well, I'll ask our congregation. And on asked the leadership team on Thursday. Sunday, we took a vote. Miriam moved in on Tuesday.
Isn't there supposed to be deep angst in the quoting of obscure theological doctrines?
We're not too much about that at First English. If we see a need, we like to make things happen.
But what about breaking the law?
Well, you know, I had to go down to ICE. That was my first act when Miriam moved in Wednesday morning. I had to go take a letter down to the ICE office and inform them that Miriam is at our church. They know full and well where she is, and let them know, because it's only a breaking the law if you're harboring, and they know where she is, so we are not harboring.
But really, I mean, this is a medieval concept, sanctuary. I mean, I'm glad it's come back. Right? I remember when one of the royalty in Spain abdicated about a decade ago, and they were talking about how powerful her family had been. And one was in medieval times, they had the right to ride their horse into the church. It's a sanctuary. I mean, people, this is a time-honored tradition that seems to have almost disappeared in modern times, where you say sanctuary and, in a sense, justice.
Well, that is the role of the church. I mean, you know, we've kind of forgotten that at times, some of us Christians, but that is the role of the church, is to be another voice for justice out in the world. I think we've kind of lost that, so I'm glad to see that there are churches bringing this back and saying, this is why Jesus came. He came for justice. He didn't just come for salvation. He came to bring justice to this earth, and we are to be his hands and feet, and we are to be working for justice.
Well, what about rendering unto Caesar? And I think we have a new Caesar, just a new president, who says, look, they're illegal. We need to round them up. There's a tremendous threat at the border. How do you respond to that?
Well, when Jesus said, give to Caesars what is Caesar, he also said, give to God what is God's. And if you're a Christian, you must believe everything is God. So we are giving back to God. And if we have man's law and we have God's law, and sometimes they work together, and we are told in the Bible to follow when they work together. But if man's law contradicts God's law, we have to make a choice, and I choose God's law.
Aren't you a little afraid of man's law if you're well, you said you weren't technically breaking the law, but, you know, there's other people out there, including occasional vigilantes.
Yeah.
Not everyone supports that position. Have you had any problems there?
We really haven't. We've had a couple, you know, negative comments on Facebook every now and then, you know, people saying we're breaking the law and this, that, and everything else. But we also had a ton of support. And that is what we focus on. We focus on the people that are out there working alongside us. We're not alone. We have, you know, quite a bit of support, which is just wonderful to see how people really are rallying around this issue, and people are supporting us and coming to help Miriam and being involved. And we actually have a meeting on Monday at the church at 1015 East Main Street at 6:30 for anybody who would like to come out and support Miriam.
And that's April 8th,
yes,
this Monday coming up. So what can you tell us about Miriam Vargas, and why was it important to give her sanctuary?
I related to Miriam's story, as you read earlier. I'm a mother of two children. They're now grown. But Miriam also, her story, she is a mother. She her choice was basically to leave her children in this country if she was deported. She has an 11-year-old and a 6-year-old, and the 6-year-old has some severe autism issues. And so her choice was to leave her children here in the foster care system, which is a drain on our government. We all know.
And overwhelmed at this point, particularly with the opioid crisis.
Correct. And they're having a hard time finding homes, you know, for other children in foster care. So here would be two more children. We all know foster care is not ideal. It would be very traumatic for the child. Or her other option was to take these two children, two female children, back to Honduras, where she would have been deported from. She's been in this country 13 years. She doesn't know people down in Honduras anymore. It's not like they send her back with, you know, here's some traveling money and here's contacts. I mean, she would just land at the airport and have to find her way. So again, the idea of going back to Honduras, where the country is riddled with gangs, if they could look at her.
And has occasional coup.
Right.
As in 2009.
Yeah, and they
literally. Not the safest, most stable place.
No, and they literally could look at her oldest child, and if they took a liking for her, just take her and say, you're one of our wives now. You're, you know, whoever you are now, you could be our sex slave, whatever. They don't have law and order like they have here in this country. They don't have that in Honduras. And so we have to understand that it's not somewhere where she would just go and necessarily. That's why she left in the first place. She was getting extorted, you know, and you constantly have to pay more money to remain safe to these gangs. Mm-hmm. These gangs rule the countryside. So what does that look like, and how is justice served by sending her and her two children, who are U.S. citizens, back to that country?
And did it matter at all the historical nature of, say, Honduras and perhaps some of the other countries down there where I would say those whole nations were held captive to the Cold War,
yeah,
between the East and West, and a lot of the weapons in those countries heavily armed from the United States, and the fighting against insurgencies and guerrilla movements, is that a lot of the reasons they're not doing well today in part was because of U.S. foreign policy?
Oh, correct. I mean, we've had a long history in these countries, and I'm not an expert on any of it by any means. But, you know, We have put goods down there that are cheaper. We have given our agriculture goods down there, which puts the farmers out of work. You know, we've just messed around in other people's countries, and now we have to deal with that.
And Miriam's still in Sanctuary?
She is. That's correct. She moved in at the beginning of July.
Now, her kids, are either of them U.S. citizens?
Both of them are U.S. citizens. So, again, you know, what are their rights to have their mother here present with them, too? And how do we think it is just? And I always like to say, too, why we're raising a generation if we just keep deporting children of undocumented people, mm-hmm. and we just deport their parents and they stay in this country. We're raising a whole generation of children that are not going to be happy with this country. And how is that helpful for this nation? There has to be a way where we can begin to talk and find a reasonable solution to these problems. Right now, there is actually no pathway to citizenship for undocumented people in this country.
Yeah, it would seem like the juvenile courts who have a duty to do what's in the best interest of the child. How could it not be in the best interest of the child to keep their mother in the U.S. to support these two U.S. citizens? Yeah. And how could it in any way, you know, help those children to send their mom down there or in any way, you know, put some pressure on them to return to a place where they don't really know the culture and haven't been raised.
Yeah. I don't know how anybody can look at Miriam's issue and think that in any way, shape, or form that this is just and that there's not some kind of better solution somehow.
Well, sometimes you hear that people like Miriam are a drain on our society, although increasingly there's a numerous report that I saw one today in the New York Times about not enough workers. Let's bring back the Mexican workers. We got no one who's able to drywall, and we had all these fires. And we're rebuilding California. So it seems like there's a double-edged sword there. On the one hand, they're accused of being a drain. On the other hand, they seem essential to the U.S. economy.
The Columbus City Council actually came out with a proposition around a month ago that actually said it was in Columbus's financial interest also to, you know, it is a drain. It's more of a drain to just deport families who are here. Miriam was here working. She was supporting her family. She wasn't taking any financial, you know, public assistance. Mm-hmm. She was just living her life, you know, and she had been here. It wasn't like she was hiding. You know, she had checked in regularly with the ICE office. They kept saying, okay, you can stay, you can stay. And then just one day she went to the ICE office and they're like, okay, you got to go. So it's not like she was sneaking around. It's not like she was doing anything illegal. She wasn't arrested. You know, it was just, this is the policy. And that's the whole problem, is there's no continuity in how ICE deals with these cases. It's random. It's at their will. And there's really, it's also, again, if you're from Mexico, Central America, the Philippines, these countries where we typically think where people are coming that are poor, there's a 20-year wait list to get any kind of citizenship, even if you come in legally. So, it's really an unjust system when you think you can come in from Norway or other white countries and you can be here and a U.S. citizen within, you know, 5 to 10 years. But if you're coming from all these other countries, it's like a minimum of a 20-year wait.
This is Bob Fitragus. You're listening to The Other Side of the News. I'm in the studio with Pastor Sally Padgett with the First English Lutheran Church. You're listening to WGRN 94.1 and also WCRS 92.7 and 98.3, the Green Renaissance. So when we put all of these things together, and you think about how many people are out there, Miriam Vargas and others, Are other churches doing enough? Are you doing some advocacy there to turn your allied churches into sanctuary churches?
Sanctuary is not the end goal. So it's not like we want to create a bunch of sanctuary churches, but we do want to inform people. So we have a number of other Lutheran churches in the city who are big supporters, who are helping out, as well as other non-Lutheran churches. And again, the idea is to create a way for people to understand what the law is, what is actually going on in this country around the issue of immigration, and how do we create and change policies so that, you know, it's a just system and that people are, you know, we're not saying every single undocumented person should just, you know, be able to either come in or stay in this country. But what does it look like to have a system that is just and fair and treats people as people instead of cattle or property or, you know, somebody who, like you said, is just a drain on society? We're not seeing people as human beings. And that's a problem.
And when we look at the questions, not only with sanctuary, which seems very inclusive, is your church inclusive?
Oh, we are. We have a sign out front that says all are welcome, and we literally
and you mean all.
We mean all is welcome. Anybody is welcome there. And again, we value diversity. We're a better world when we are around people that are not just like us. When we can see each other and see God and other people and learn to love everybody around us for exactly who they are at any time.
So how does a First English Lutheran Church, referring to the first, I suppose I was speaking, the First Lutheran Church in Central Ohio that was speaking English instead of German.
Right.
And how does a church like yours become so inclusive? What do you attribute that to?
I think it's just kind of in the DNA of the church. Like I said, we were the first, you know, back in 1848, they were radicals back then. Speaking English in a Lutheran church in 1848 was radical. And they've always been welcoming and affirming. And I think it's just, again, if you're trying to live out God's call, Jesus welcomed everybody. Jesus loved everybody. Jesus, you know, so if we're living out our call, we are to welcome. We are to love. Our call is to love. Our call is not to judge. So anybody is welcome. And again, that is our role, being hospitable, opening our doors, and loving on people who walk through the door and helping to provide whatever we can, support we can for what they need.
Now, wasn't it Pastor Bob that was down
there? Pastor Bob Ward.
He's been on this show as well, and again, well known for urban ministry, which you say you're attracted to.
Yeah.
Speaking of diversity, not only racial and ethnic and sexual, but in terms of income.
Yeah.
I mean, you're in an area of the city that's got some really bad historical statistics in terms of health problems, and of course, you know, how long children live at birth.
Yeah, and right now it's gentrifying. There's a lot going on about, you know, it's kind of a hotbed of everything. But again, that's how if you walk into our worship service on a Sunday morning, you have old, young, rich, poor, black, white, you know, now Hispanic. I mean, there's just a little of everybody there. And again, that's what the kingdom of God is going to look like. It's not going to be, you know, all white or all black or all whatever. You know, we're going to have a little bit of everybody. We have gay, straight. I mean.
So you are getting a few of those with the 15-year 100% tax abatement.
Like I said, we open our doors and we suspend.
Well, good. They're going to have a little resource from that
we
tax
can use
abatement
some of those,
to
yeah.
give back to the community. So that's your job.
Yeah.
To persuade them. And and again, it's a diverse neighborhood. There's been tension in the past between, you know, long-time neighbors.
Yeah, Flag Wars was a documentary made a number of years ago.
Exactly. I knew Nina quite well on one side, my realtor, and my client, Ariadne, was on the other side.
Yeah.
So I was caught in the middle of that one. But so, and a lot of these, I'm in your East Area Commissioner, but a lot of these questions continue. So when you speak of church redevelopment in an area like this, what does that mean?
Well, the Lutheran Church is a church where, like most mainline denominations, there's a, you know, a lot of churches that are declining instead of, you know, growing. So it's the idea of actually rerooting in your community where you are and getting to, you know, for, I mean, about before Pastor Bob came, about 12 years ago, the church was getting ready to close its doors.
It was mainly known as an office for some
universal
healthcare groups.
Yeah. I mean, it was, it, you know, they, I think they worshiped less than 20 people on a Sunday, and it was, you know, it was dying. But then Pastor Bob came in and he rerouted in the community, meaning he went out and he met the neighbors. He said, "We're here to help you. How do we, you know, how do we partner with you in this neighborhood? How do we support you to give those in the community a voice? How do we work alongside you to be a good neighbor?" And that is what redevelopment is. It's going out into the neighborhoods and saying, "We want to be a good neighbor. How do we partner with you? And how do we lift you up? How do we support you? And how do you support us? And how do we exchange gifts to make the neighborhood a better neighborhood?"
And is your church associated with Bread?
Actually, we are not. Bread seems to have, not that there's anything wrong with Bread, but Bread is kind of, they like to come in and do projects. It's a more top-down. We really believe in asset community development, where the people in the neighborhood know what is needed. The people in the neighborhood have the resources, and we just want to walk alongside them. So I'm not saying anything negative about Bread. But
sure, sure. But again, they're sort of known for, here's the agenda.
Right.
And it's really usually a liberal, social justice, progressive agenda.
Right.
I'm not saying that, but you're just taking a different
approach. Exactly. We're just trying to say people in the neighborhood know what the neighborhood needs. People in the neighborhood know where the, you know, what more about the neighborhood than anybody coming in could ever
and
know.
And often it's jobs that pay well.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
With benefits.
Right. And a fair living wage.
Yes.
Yeah. So we try to just, like I said, support. We work with local communities to, you know, help employ, get people jobs. And again, we do everything from working and helping people do resumes to helping people with resources such as clothing and meals. Right now, there's a meal going on at the church while I'm here. So,
okay. And this bridges out of poverty. What's the essence of that training?
It's by Ruby Payne. It's material that was written a number of years ago, and we really focus on the hidden rules of class. What people don't realize is we live in a middle-class world, a world that's based off middle-class values, and that people in wealth and people in poverty grow up with different hidden rules, and they don't understand the rules of the middle class. And so we try to teach people. Mostly we go out to white suburban churches and try to help people understand what they're seeing when they look at persons in poverty. They don't, like, the middle class values most is achievement. We are, you have to send your kid to college. You have to have a retirement account. You have to do these things to achieve. And what we're trying to teach people is that wealth values connections more than anything else, and that people in poverty value, and again, this is not everybody, but we're, you know, overall people in poverty tend to value relationships more than achievement. And so that makes a difference in how they view the world. And we just try to get people to understand the world from a different point of view.
And that brings us back to this whole question of sanctuary. Why should we value relations with someone like Miriam Vargas or Edith Espinal? What is it about a relationship with them that would be valuable?
Everybody has a story. Everybody is who they are because of their past, because of their story. And that is what life is about engaging people where they're at, hearing their story and understanding. And the reality is sometimes we get so focused on policy or procedure and money or whatever else, getting resources. And life is about people and stories and just trying to get to know people. So again, Miriam and Edith are people, and as a Christian, I'm supposed to treat people as I want to be treated. So if I would I want to have to live in a church building and raise my children in a church building? No. So I'm going to fight as much as I can for justice and so that they can live their best life. And the reality is too, if we start trying to help our neighbor, we're the ones that are blessed by it because we get to know somebody else and that person it will change our lives.
Well, clearly it's not abstract. You can watch TV and go, well, that's a shame they're separating families. But,
right.
I mean, knowing these people and having them in sanctuary really humanizes the situation. You're dealing with real people instead of some image on TV.
And Miriam is literally the most sweetest, generous woman I think I've ever met. I mean, just knowing her, people change our lives just by knowing them. And I think that's what we forget is it's not about a policy. It's about people. It's about human beings. And who we are as a society, we are only as good as we treat others around us, especially the vulnerable.
How can the listeners help Miriam Vargas and her family while she remains in sanctuary?
Well, we're starting to organize our approach to how we want to get her out. And again, so we invite everybody to the meeting on April 8th, this coming Monday, and at 6:30 at the church at 1015 East Main Street. And again, learn. If you don't know much about immigration, if you think that we're breaking the law, if you think, you know, they just need a path to citizenship, all these things, you know, these little lines that you hear over and over again, do your homework, do your research, know what you're talking about, and realize, again, how would you want to be treated in a foreign country? How would you want people to treat you, respect you? And then just get involved. Talk to your legislatures, talk to, you know, people in government, and vote.
All right, Pastor Sally Padgett at the First English Lutheran Church. We hope to have you back on the show. And listeners out there, we'd love to hear any feedback from you. Please email us at comments@wgrn.org. That's comments@wgrn.org if you've got any input regarding the show. And again, thanks again. For redeveloping, providing sanctuary, and living in the finest tradition of Jesus.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to The Other Side of the News. This is Bob Fitrakis.
And Dan Dugan, WGRN 94.1 LPFM, The Green Renaissance.